Welcome to the Crypto 101 podcast, presented by Gemini, your bridge to the future of money.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast. And this is a special one. Man, I'm really, really excited. This is as real time as it gets. The market's above all-time highs. Things are pumping, altcoins are going crazy, but we're just feeling like we're at the beginning of this incredible Q4 rally. I was looking through some charts. You know, it feels like 2025 has just been a lot of consolidation, a lot of compression, despite, you know, Bitcoin being up big. The rest of the market hasn't really gone full bore yet, and Q4 is typically kind of when this stuff unfolds. We got a sweetheart sort of setup here, Goldilocks windows, and I'm bringing on a legendary trader and investor who's been in crypto since, I mean, I'll ask him, I think since 2012, making some investments in Ripple, folks like Coinbase, early in, you know, Bitfinex, Kraken, Circle, you, like, pretty much you name it. Everybody who's like all these different firms that are building the infrastructure of the space, Kyle Chassé has been an investor in. He's the founder of MD Global. Kyle, we are so pumped to have you join us. We're recording here Monday, October 6th. How the hell are you? And thanks for joining.
Hey, Bryce. Thanks for having me, first of all, and feeling great. It's interesting after being in this space since 2012, like you said, and you know, in the early days. Well, really, it wasn't really until I started doing YouTube, and initially for the first couple of years was part-time, and then the last 2 years has been full-time. I just, you know, I had a lot of Bitcoin back in 2013 when I sold my company and bought Bitcoin with it. And then from that point all the way until, you know, I never had any other revenue streams. Just as like an entrepreneur trying to figure out how to build in crypto and what to do, and spent a lot of my Bitcoin on, you know, startups and failures. And it wasn't until 2021 when we launched Paid as a launchpad, which was the first time I started making some money again. But the point is that through that time from 2012 until 2021, you know, Bitcoin has had its cycles, and I never really, my mindset wasn't about making money at the time. I knew that eventually Bitcoin would go up to a price to where, like, I was okay, but I still wanted to do something interesting in the world. And then realizing how much Bitcoin I used to have versus how much I have today, spending it, losing it, over-leveraging, all these kind of mistakes that were made, I better start paying attention, you know, on how to retain capital and grow that. And so really having the YouTube channel has helped me a lot in understanding markets and macro conditions and market cycles and these kind of things. And so, yes, I've been in it for a long time. I've been paying attention to the macro cycles and macro conditions since about, you know, 2020, 2021 to try to learn, you know, what's going on and how to predict and pay attention to what's going on in the future a bit better. But the point that I was making about all-time highs is that even after all this time, if you're in this full time and you have a lot of your net worth wrapped up in it, it's almost impossible to separate yourself emotionally from the market conditions. Like, yeah, you know, when you wake up and you see all-time highs, you're just in a better mood. Right. And
yeah, like totally.
Bitcoin. And then when the markets are sideways for a whole year, like they have been, like that whole time, it's just like life to me at that point seems kind of like just like the price. It just seems kind of boring and sideways, you know? So I guess we live, those of us who are super deep into it, live our life emotionally based on the charts a little bit. And I don't think that's anything, as much as you try to separate yourself emotionally from the prices, like, it just affects you one way or another, you know? So I think most people are in a good mood today.
Yeah. And it's funny, you know, prices really are a chart or a graph of like human emotion over time. And so it is hard to extract yourself from that. But I found one of the successful trading adages has been to invert the chart sometimes, right? Because if you invert the chart, you're like, oh, well, the prices are up huge. Maybe I'm going to take a little profits off. Prices are down huge. Maybe I'm going to add a little bit. But it seems like right now, I don't want to invert the chart. I want to keep buying, even though we're high, because it feels like we're just beginning this breakout. You know, again, once, you know, kind of crypto starts to trade above its all-time high in like a total market cap perspective, which we're just starting to do, there's very little price resistance above us. It seems like we're in this price discovery mode. But the one like kind of chip to fall, at least in my opinion, before we get really crazy, is Ethereum above all-time highs. And I think we're close. In fact, by the time people are watching this, You know, first thing in the morning tomorrow, we're going to edit it. We're going to get it out. Ethereum might be above 5K, but once we get that 5 handle on Ethereum, there's going to be that wealth effect. People are going to really be like, you know, I'm starting to get calls, people personally starting to reach out like, hey, like, did I already miss out? Like, it feels like things are starting to come. So I feel that groundswell happening. But, you know, take us back to 2012 and in just in your mindset, what was standing out to you that allowed you to take such enormous risk on these early, early crypto companies? Was it something philosophical? Was it something in the fundamentals? How were you so prescient to get into some of these early rounds, early companies, early exposure, when a lot of people weren't even thinking that crypto was going to be a thing?
Sure, I'll answer that. And then I guess you're probably going to want to go into market cycles and stuff like that. So just remind me to talk about a couple of things, institutional FOMO, and then, like you said, the new people who are texting you, because I have some insight on that, which I think is quite interesting.
All right, Crypt Nation fam, let's pause for 1 second and talk about an important issue going on right now, and that's SIM swap attacks. SIM swap attacks are becoming a serious threat, especially in crypto. If someone gets control of your phone number, they can access your bank accounts, your exchanges, emails, and even your private messages. That's why the Crypto 101 podcast is partnered with Afani. It's America's most secure mobile service, offering a guaranteed protection against SIM swaps with added privacy. Since launching, not one single Afani user has ever been SIM swapped. And for some reason, if it ever does happen, you're backed by up to $5 million in insurance against financial losses. This is literally why we chose to partner with them. It is our favorite thing about Afani is the insurance policy of up to $5 million if it does happen to you. Afani runs on either AT&T or the Verizon network, and you get to choose which one. There are no contracts, and it is super easy and seamless to sign up. You also get a 60-day money-back guarantee, so there's zero risk in trying it out. Right now, for our listeners, you get $99 off when you sign up at afani.com/crypto101. That's afani.com/crypto101, or check the show notes below for a link. These days, your phone number is probably more valuable than your social security number. So make sure it's protected with Afani.
All right, Crypt Nation fam, are you interested in effortlessly growing your Bitcoin portfolio? Because I know I am. The Bitcoin credit card by Gemini earns you Bitcoin back on every purchase. Use it like any credit card. You buy lunch, you get gas, any of your weekly grocery expenses, and you'll earn up to 4% back instantly in Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos straight into your account. All that with no annual fee. And right now, you can grab $200 of Bitcoin. That's right, a $200 Bitcoin welcome bonus with the Gemini credit card. It is the easiest way to start building your Bitcoin stack. Go to Gemini.com/card to learn more. Terms apply. See the link in the description for more information regarding rates and fees. If you have been considering futures trading, now might be the time to take a closer look. The futures market has seen increased activity recently, and Plus 500 Futures offers a straightforward entry point. The platform provides access to major instruments, including the S&P 500, NASDAQ, Bitcoin, natural gas, and other key markets across equity indices like energy, metals, Forex, and crypto. Their interface is designed for accessibility. You can monitor and execute trades from your phone with a $100 minimum deposit. Once your account is open, potential trades can be executed in 2 clicks. For those who prefer to practice first, Plus 500 offers an unlimited demo account with full charting and analytical tools. No risk involved while you familiarize yourself with the platform. The company has been operating in the trading space for over 20 years. Download the Plus 500 app today. Trading in futures involves a risk of loss and is not suitable for everyone. Not all applicants will qualify.
Going back to 2012 is when I first learned about Bitcoin. And at that time, I had a startup. It was called the Reverse Aging Institute. The whole 10 years before that, I was working in longevity. And there wasn't a whole lot of value in the business itself because it was basically a consulting company for these high net worth individuals, which was me being able to provide what I knew. So the guy bought the company just for the branding, which was cool. Like I did a 3X on the branding, you know, like $30,000, $40,000 in branding. I sold it for like $120,000. And I put that in Bitcoin in 2013, and I started a Bitcoin lottery called World Super Lotto. And the idea was like, you know, I had heard on the radio a state lottery was like $300 something million. I thought, wow, that's crazy. What if you put one lottery for every state of the United States together? That would be in like the billions of dollars. But then there's like lotteries in every country in the world, right? And like, so what if you had this global lottery that could exist with this currency that wasn't regulated, that no one cared about? But like, I also thought adoption would come sooner than it actually did. So I just experimented and I just really copy-pasted like the California state lottery. website design, the way the numbers were picked. I bought this this lottery machine, the physical one from China, shipped it to my house in America, and then twice a week ran live streaming videos of a lottery. And I was pseudo-anonymous at the time because I knew that people, like, I thought Bitcoin was very disruptive, and I know that anyone who's been very disruptive to anything in the United States before has been, like, met with a lot of force. And I knew that, like, Bitcoin would maybe challenge US dollar one day. And so I thought, well, I don't want to be publicly known for someone doing this stuff right now, so I'll be pseudo-anonymous. But the conviction came really from, you know, one, I saw what was happening with Silk Road and how that was, like, that whole thing blew my mind. That was how I first learned about it, was learning about Silk Road. But it wasn't like the drug marketplace or the Bitcoin, or even I discovered the dark web at that time. It wasn't any of those one things together that was so specifically aha. It was like, how is this eBay for drugs, like, allowed to take place and people are paying for it, like, with this Bitcoin thing? But then when I saw WikiLeaks using it to start accepting donations, that was the aha moment when I was like, okay, this is an organization who, in my mind, was doing a net positive for the world. And before that, a bit of history, I was always a tinfoil hat guy, you know, the teenager who was watching all the documentaries about the Federal Reserve and this being a scam and that being a scam. And so when I saw WikiLeaks doing what it did, and I saw that they weren't, all the centralized powers were putting pressure on all the payment gateways to shut down their donations, and then Bitcoin was the thing that they had to default to enable them to continue to operate, like, that was the big aha moment. So I just thought this was super interesting. And I'd always felt also, like, at that point, I wasn't interested in voting in the United States. I didn't think that actually mattered to much degree. Like, you know, in my life, in my parents' life, like, a president of the United States had never made a difference in the way that they lived their life or their circumstances. And I also felt that, like, because lobbying was allowed to exist, that these mega corporations were always allowed to influence politicians, and, like, as long as lobbying could exist.
Citizens United.
Yeah, and as long as lobbying could exist, like, I didn't think that there was actually really fair politics or politicians could get things done in a meaningful way. So I wanted to do something that was meaningful to the world, but I felt like there was no real call to action at that point before Bitcoin, because nothing was able to get around the centralized power control, the military industrial complex, the pharmacy industrial complex, all these things. So Bitcoin was the first thing that said, wow, like, this is able to circumvent these centralized powers of control. It's the first thing that made me feel like this aha moment where, you know, it could disrupt a lot of these things that were bothering me. And so I just wanted to be involved in it somehow. So yes, I acquired quite a bit in 2013. And then I did the lottery for fun. It was just like, hey, let's see. Like, I didn't think this was going to make a ton of money, but it was like, how can I build something with Bitcoin?
It was experimental. And so I did. Yeah, it was experimental, and it took off. And it's so interesting. I love your story because it really does, you know, we've got, you know, all sorts of different guests that come on the show, and everybody gets into crypto at a different time for a different reason. But yours really rings true to kind of the cypherpunk ideals of, you know, almost this anarcho-capitalist kind of viewpoint. Whereas, you know, back in 2012, it was this, you know, gray money in a sense. And the industry has evolved so much, and now you see it on, you got commercials on TV, you know, you got the most you know, important people in finance like BlackRock and Fidelity and Morgan Stanley all talking about, yeah, now we're gonna give you guys Bitcoin exposure. Like, what do you think, somebody who's seen it evolve from 2012 to 2025, kind of, what is your, you know, are you disillusioned? Do you think the industry's lost its way? Did you kind of always anticipate, like, of course this is going to happen? If you're going to go to global adoption, you need to have some global regulation. How do you pair the two in your mind?
Well, it's interesting. So my mindset, you know, keep in mind, 13 years ago, when I took the only capital that I had from the sale of that business, because I had zero in the bank, like, at that business, basically. But when I sold it, I had that 120 grand or whatever. And for me, it didn't feel like I was taking a huge risk. You know, I was young. And, like, my whole entrepreneurial path hadn't really taken off yet at that point. And so I didn't feel like I was, like, being super risky putting this money. I didn't have that mindset of like, I just thought that Bitcoin, you know, was the place that I should store my money rather than fiat. And then what I did have a strong feeling, a sense of conviction that, like, there was always going to be a market for Bitcoin. You know, whether that means that it's only going to be used for illicit activities and people who wanted to be, you know, and also in 2013, we really thought that Bitcoin was more, like, anonymous than it actually is, right? We come to find out later, and, you know, that it's very traceable. The three-letter agencies love it because they can always find who's doing stuff with Bitcoin, you know. But at the time, though, it felt we kind of all suspected that it was like this anonymous way to send money back and forth. So I thought that at the time it would definitely be used as a world currency for some sort of people, and more than was using it in 2013. So I thought that even like at a smaller level of adoption, it would still be popular and used. And then I guess like every year, let's say that my at that time too, 2013, I did suspect that maybe it would be a world reserve currency one day. But I guess at that point, my conviction was only maybe 40% or something like that, right? Like, but probably each passing year after that, that conviction maybe grew by 10%. And then, you know, I guess by 2000, I guess maybe 2017 or 18 or something like that, I thought for sure this would eventually become a world reserve currency, because you understand that the other ones that exist today, like they're not programmed to work long term. Like the US dollar today, for example, it can't sustain the path that it's on right now. It has one path forward, and that is, you know, debased and devalued. So then I knew it would become a world reserve currency. What you said, the BlackRock's and Fidelity's, and don't forget too, we just had Vanguard finally bend the knee and say, okay, we're also going to start allowing our clients. And that was a big turning point too, because if you put on your tinfoil hat, you know, and you look a little bit deeper, you know, Vanguard is more of a privately managed fund who we don't really know. There's not as much as transparency as who is the major money behind that. There's a lot of people that suspect that, you know, Vanguard was maybe more that old kind of elitist globalist money, the Rothschilds, the Vanderbilts, the JP Morgans, these kind of guys. And so, you know, seeing them eventually coming into it feels like this is the path of finally being accepted for sure. I made a really interesting video, actually. Maybe I can share it with you guys. You can link it in the description below.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It's kind of my take on the who is Satoshi thing.
Okay.
And it's more of a thought experiment than I have any idea that this is true or not. But the TLDR of that, and if people want to watch the video to get more data of why I have this theory, they can. But the TLDR is that what if Bitcoin was actually created by the same folks who have been controlling the US dollar for a century? It's the people who created the Federal Reserve. Famous Rothschild.
Their off-ramp, maybe.
The famous Rothschild's quote is like, give me the ability to control the money of a nation and I care not who makes the laws, right? And so think about this for a second. If you are these families who created the Federal Reserve and you control the banking, you know, all the money and the dollar, and you've been doing that for a long time, you have unlimited resources and you have unlimited power. So it just seems to, and you're probably very smart as well. It seems to me that like if you're in that position, you're always playing offense and defense to make sure that you're never disrupted, right? And so like you're always going to be looking ahead and saying, who's trying to challenge us? Who's trying to, you know, take away the power of the dollar? And what could come next after every free fiat currency that's ever existed or major currency that's ever ruled the world in the past, the Great British Pound and the ones before that, they all had this like 100-year lifespan. And so these guys who were controlling the dollar must have obviously known that, studied history, and also studied, you know, modern monetary policy, which is very inflationary and based on debt and not sustainable, that like when the dollar inevitably comes to an end, like, are you still going to be in power for the next century or not? And so either they were looking for, end of the video, I go into a lot of details about how the NSA, you know, there's a lot of similarities with the Bitcoin code and the encryptions that they use and the patents that they had. So CIA, NSA. So I think it's a fun thought experiment to think, what if these guys actually created Bitcoin? And the thing is, like with BRICS currencies, or BRICS trying to also maybe overthrow the dollar and create their own currency.
Right.
Like the U.S. is not going to let that happen without a war, right? Like there's no way the U.S. just quietly observes while the BRICS nations gather and create a powerful currency. Like the thing about today, though, is these major superpowers have too much actual firepower to want to start a really major war. That's scary as shit. Like everyone knows that, you know, you start launching nukes and it's mutually assured destruction and the whole planet goes to shit.
Right.
So no longer is it a place where through military we can demand that you use our US dollar or demand that you use our Chinese yuan. Like it has to feel like the next reserve currency is organic and it comes from an apolitical space, you know, and it had its challenges along the way, and then blah, 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 and eventually it became accepted, right? And if you have this plan from the beginning and you have the first million Bitcoin like Satoshi does, and as your plan started to become more successful and adopted, and it seemed like it was becoming more and more feasible that this was going to work, you could have been acquiring it along the way to make sure that now you have, instead of 1 million Bitcoin, you have 2 or 3 or 4 million. And then again, then when the dollar falls and Bitcoin does become the world reserve currency, you still have the most control over it and the most of it. So that's a fun thought experiment. I don't know if it's true or not. Like, Satoshi could be this benevolent superhero that we all hoped he was. But I guess the bottom line is, like, it doesn't really matter which is true. The path forward for Bitcoin is inevitable. It's apolitical. Anyone in the world can have it and buy it easily. The infrastructure is being set up all over the world from all the major institutions. And at this point, we've already reached the inflection point where there's no going back. Bitcoin is for sure going to be a world reserve currency. I mean, a lot of people don't say that because especially politicians and leaders and Larry Fink and Howard Lutnick and stuff like that, they're not going to say that, even though they probably feel that it is going to be, because right now they have a responsibility to preserve the US dollar. But I think most people understand what's happening.
No, it's a great kind of overview. And it makes me think, like, you know, in this world of, you know, being philosophically driven in a sense that, you know, this is the new form of money, it's the reserve currency of the world, do you think that there's credence or like right to exist for altcoins, things like Ethereum, Solana, and then so down the risk spectrum? Or are you what would be called a Bitcoin maximalist?
Yeah, I'm not a maximalist at all. I think Bitcoin, so like blockchain was this like really cool invention that allowed us to have consensus in a decentralized way that's immutable. And that's very valuable for many use cases. Money was just like Satoshi's, he thought was like the most important thing that we the people needed to have sovereignty over. And so like he created blockchain for the most important thing that he thought should be disrupted first. But then like there's a lot of other great use cases for decentralized systems with transparency, transparent and immutable governance, or governance that at least is voted on by the people in consensus. And so when you think about, especially as we move forward with automation and AI, like I believe that anything, any system, any organization, any application that can efficiently and effectively be governed without like a huge central corporation running things, should and will be. When you think about the economics of decentralized applications, let's say like there's a good argument for both sides of the coin on Uber or Airbnb or something like that. Like one, people will say it should always be centralized because a centralized team is what has allowed Uber to scale and grow to the scale that it is today and be so successful and blah, blah, blah. You know, maybe ride sharing doesn't need to have food delivery and robo taxis flying through the air and stuff like that, like Uber's expanding to. Maybe like if you could just disrupt ride sharing on a decentralized application, meaning removing the middlemen and allowing that 30% profit that Uber takes to be shared by both the passenger and the driver to make the driver make more money on every trip and have the passenger pay less for every trip. Like if you open a ride sharing aggregator app that is Uber, Lyft, Grab, all the other ones, but then there's this new decentralized Uber, let's call it Duber, right? And you open Duber and you want to get from your house to the airport. And like on Uber, it's at $100, but in Duber, it's only $80, right? The driver makes more money, you pay less money. And like, which driver wouldn't want to use that application? Which passenger wouldn't want to? You get the exact same experience because no one ever calls 1-800-Uber to talk to customer service. It's not needed, right? Like it's all able to govern itself. So, how big does this Duber get as far as going into the future of full automation? And it could, right? Because the devs, the people who created it, the founders have 10 or 20% of the supply of the token. So if they continue to innovate and develop and ship, then the economic value of the ecosystem goes up. And so they're incentivized, just like any other founder, to increase the enterprise value of that application. And so they do have incentive to continue to innovate and things like that. So, but again, for the majority of people in the world, they're going to take the option that it costs less, or the driver is going to take the option that pays them more, so long as the experience is virtually the same. And so I think that these are good examples, like Airbnb and Uber and others, of these peer-to-peer services that currently have middlemen extracting value from that situation. So I love the idea of decentralized applications. I'm a little bit disappointed that we don't have more of that. Like we don't have any of these, like none of them have really taken off on mainstream yet. But I think that has a lot to do with this experimentation that we've been doing since Ethereum existed of how do you get the tokenomics right? How do you get the economics of the revenue and the value distribution? Most of the time, these people have built these decentralized applications they build them with a centralized mindset, meaning that, hey, we're going to raise money in equity. Hey, we're going to sell this token. Hey, we're going to earn revenue, but we're going to earn revenue and we're going to keep it into this, the equity side of the business, and the token has no real utility. Today, people are starting to realize, you hear it more and more from the Hyperliquids and the Asters, and we're going to take the revenue that we earn and we're going to put it back into the token so that the only economic value is in the token model. The equity side has no value in the business, right? It's just like, so all the revenue, the real world adoption, that's going back into buying the token, hopefully burning or redistributing through rewards or whatever. They're creating one token economy versus what people have been doing, the greedy founders who either were naive, committing fraud or stupid or whatever, but they were having one business that had two economic models, which means when you get revenue from doing sales or whatever, where does it go, right? And if you're diluting that by going 50-50 or eight, I hear a lot of people say, oh, we're gonna do 10% revenue buybacks. Well, what the fuck did you sell? Like, why did you create two different paths for investors, one on the equity side and one on the token side? Never before crypto did we ever have a business model that had two different pools of people to take care of, right? It was very easy for a centralized company with equity to understand how that equity is valued. It's just, what is the revenue and the profits of the company? That goes back into the share price, right? But now you have people who are creating these economic models where they're now having two pools of people to take care of, and they often ignore the token model. So the adoption has come, I think, from a lack of understanding how to build good economic models, lack of understanding of how to do governance, a lack of having nice UX and UI in crypto. Like, for most people, transacting on Ethereum feels like slow and antiquated, but now we have Solana and Sui and these other things. And then blockchain is supposed to be just infrastructure, right? Like, that's all it's supposed to be, right? People should be using these decentralized apps like Duber, for example, and it should feel just like a Web2 application, right? They shouldn't have to connect their wallet and have to sign all these things that they don't understand what they're signing, and have these 12 word password phrases that if they lose it, your money's gone and you're out of luck. Like, these things are very intimidating for most people coming into the space, and they don't feel like a nice user experience. And so as we're starting to build technology that abstracts away that complicated Web3 part from the end user, then infrastructure can feel like infrastructure again. It's something that we just know is there. We trust that it works well, and we don't have to interact with it. It's like a bridge, the roads, the foundation of a house, you know, the structure of a skyscraper, whatever. We don't have to check the integrity of these things before we use them. We just trust that they're solid, sound, and that they give us the ability to build these things on top of. And so that's where I think that we're heading. Bull run this season, we're just starting to see, again, what the first thing of disruptive blockchain technology was for, money. And so now we're seeing money technology being adopted into the application level. So this season feels like we're last bull runs, we had all these narratives of like, we're going to disrupt gaming. We're going to disrupt, you know, social media. We're going to disrupt whatever it was. But that was too far of a stretch of people's imaginations to come at the time. It was like, I don't understand why we need these things, like whatever. But now, it's going back to the roots of like, how do we build applications to disrupt money again? But this time it's the money infrastructure. It's the rails, it's the banks. And so now we're seeing DeFi, like with the most TVL we've ever seen, the most users we've ever seen on DeFi. And when people use good DeFi applications, they're thinking to themselves, when they finally get it, they're like, why the hell would I ever go to a bank again to take out a loan when I can go to Aave and get a loan in 12 seconds, right? Like, yeah. With no questions asked, no KYC, no nothing. Phenomenal experience, right? Looking now, you see all of the major players like Swift and everyone else upgrading their antiquated infrastructure of 3 days to do a bank's, you know, settlement or $100 or whatever, and now they're going on chain because it's more efficient and faster and more transparent, and it gives them all the tools that they need. So everyone's upgrading to essentially DeFi and blockchain rails right now. And so I think that's the first kind of application that people. It's easier for people to grasp and understand because, again, it's kind of just modernizing the traditional finance infrastructure, putting on chain, and a lot of it's not fully decentralized. Some of it is, but again, people will also eventually realize if they have someone like a centralized, like a bank that's building infrastructure, and then a decentralized competitor of it, but the UX is very similar. Mm-hmm. People are going to start using the decentralized version. Why? Because it's got better fees, more yield, no KYC. You can use it from anywhere in the world. You don't have to trust a centralized entity. So eventually, as people start to get more comfortable using blockchain and the idea of it, they will start to use these things more in mass, and then we'll start to see more adoption.
No, you hit the nail on the head, and I think that this is the DeFi bull run that we've all been waiting for. I mean, in the last bull run, it felt like DeFi didn't really run as hard. I mean, in 2020, you know, I should say the DeFi summer of 2020, I mean, that was a really good time. 2021 a little bit, but really haven't seen DeFi catch a serious, serious bid. And I think you're right. Like, DeFi is built to meet this moment. Like the institutional grade, regulated sort of, you know, industry meeting crypto. It's like DeFi is right there to meet the moment. The RWA stuff. So I'm super optimistic on it. And I think also what's driving a lot of interest and flows and, you know, is the market structures evolving, right? And so we have these ETFs that are coming online. Obviously, the Bitcoin ETF was like the most successful ETF that was ever launched by like several different metrics and AUM, and it's the most profitable ETF for BlackRock. And so the fastest ETF to like $80 billion under management, did it 5 times faster than the VOO, which is like S&P 500. Like, crazy, you know, success of these ETFs. But the thing that's on the horizon is these altcoin ETFs, which, you know, our community is really excited about, because the SEC kind of under Trump now has come out and said, we're going to take a different view of the last SEC 180, and we're going to bring the altcoin market to the public markets. And so we're going to basically give you generic listing standards for all these different altcoins. And I see you nodding along. I want to get your take on this. Is this big? Is this a MacGuffin? Is it, you know, going to fall flat on its face? Like, what is getting altcoins into these ETF wrappers do? And how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, so it's interesting because for someone like myself, you know, who who've been in the industry for like, you know, at least a season or more, we've had enough time to kind of digest what these different use cases are for these different blockchains or these different tokens or whatever. But for the majority of the world, and most money that comes into these ETFs, they don't understand anything past Bitcoin, and they barely understand Bitcoin now. And some of them are still trying to learn from their financial advisors right now. You know, you got the sales guys at BlackRock going and playing golf with their old money people, and they've had 12 golf sessions, and like just now they're starting to get uncomfortable with the idea of what is Bitcoin, right? And like, and maybe they're gonna start allocating 1% of their portfolio to it this year, right? And they're like, okay, well, let's see how it goes this year. Next year, if it's doing well, we'll allocate another 1 or 2%, right?
They move at a glacial pace, these old school guys.
This old money is—they also have so much money that it's just not really interesting for them to take the risk anymore. Like, they're just living great off their interest alone that BlackRock's already making them of 6 or 8 or 10% a year, whatever it is. Like, they see no need to be super risky. But the thing that I was asking you to remind me about later—the thing is that like FOMO. Even for people who don't get FOMO, like if you're old and you've got $100 million or $1 billion, like you don't really get FOMO much in the money world anymore. Like, you're good, and like you're not worried about missing the next 100x or something.
Yeah. It's like you've already made it.
You already made it, and like your interest alone is keeping you, like, you're not spending $10 million a year on your interest. Like, it's fine. There is something about just the interest of Bitcoin, and someone who's been watching it long enough, let's say they've been watching it since, you know, 29,000 or 50,000, and like they keep thinking about it, and they've been watching it for a couple of years, or even people who haven't, like, price is a real interesting thing. And so what I was alluding to earlier is, now that we're coming into price discovery and all-time highs, if Bitcoin moves up and to the right, like in a linear fashion, nice and slow, like it has since 2022, it doesn't really give people like that sense of urgency to like finally deploy, right? But when we go into what we're expecting to happen over the next few months right now, and this seasonality of Q4 after a post-halving year, Bitcoin doesn't do a linear progression. It starts to go parabolic, and so do altcoins, right? And that FOMO of not putting money into it, when these markets start moving at like total market cap starts increasing by like 5% a day or 10% a day because Bitcoin's going up at 1 or 2 or 3% every single day for months on end, and ETH is doing like 4, 5, 6%, and then altcoins are doing 10, 20, 30% in a day for literally like a month or, you know, 6 weeks straight. That temptation, that FOMO is such a contagious kind of feeling. One of the things—
Nobody can fight it.
One of the things that I've been battling with this season was like, is there enough money in the economy from 99%? Who have been struggling since COVID, struggling with inflated prices, wages not keeping up, Credit card debt is at all-time highs right now. People are starting to default on car loans more than ever. The housing market's in big trouble. Interest rates have been high for a while. We're not in a very, we're not in a quantitative easing state yet. We haven't had massive injection of stimulus, although Trump just said he might do with like a $2,000 stimmy check, which would be amazing. That would, you know, remind us of the COVID stimulus, which boosted our markets. When I start to think about it, what do we need for parabolic altcoin rally explosion? You need retail money to come in because institutions aren't going out and buying like $2 million meme coins, right? Like they're just not going to do that, but retail will, right? And and so I think that interesting thing about that FOMO factor is like, even if right now you're living paycheck to paycheck and times have been hard since COVID and you don't really have money to go to the movies or to take your family out to nice dinner or whatever, but you start to see like altcoin mania and like on your timeline of whatever social media you're on, you just see like this guy put in, you know, $1,000 into something and now it's worth 3 million. Like it's the story of lottery winners happening every single day on social media. It's not like the lottery. Like it seems like your average Joe is like making generational money on gambling on meme coins or some low cap altcoin or whatever. And so I think that temptation and that reputation is just too much for even people that can't afford to do it, to go take out a line of credit, to go sell their car, mortgage their house. Like, and I think that...
Sounds like you're describing a casino in a sense.
Yeah, I think I feel like, unfortunately, like that might be where we're headed. I mean, unfortunately for most people, because it doesn't end well for those kind of people who FOMO in toward the top, right? And then think it's just going to keep going. It's a first cycle, or they, you know, haven't learned from previous cycles. But that's what usually creates these blow-off tops, is like when everyone just goes all in, mortgages the house, sells a kidney, whatever, that's when the markets are just exploding and ripping, and that's your top signal, right? And so when I really think about it, I do feel like that's going to happen. For a while there, I was just worried that we weren't going to have like a parabolic season. I thought that like it was just going to continue to go until it like slowly rolled over, and then we ended the business cycle, liquidity dried up, tightening conditions started happening again, and then we just got this like very like anticlimactic bull run. But I do think that we're going to see another big bull run. And the question is, how long will it last, right? And I don't have the answer to that. I've always hated technical analysis. I thought it was like just astrology for crypto bros. But like, the more that I see people who really study charts and patterns, like they seem to be like fairly accurate with things. Maybe not on day trading so much, but like more on just like general timelines and things. So I guess like that what we're doing is just we're kind of expecting that we're going to see very similar pattern to the previous cycles, where this cycle ends at the end of this year, and kind of planning for that. You'll really know if you feel very rich, and you know everyone that you know that's never done crypto starts asking again. Coinbase app is at number one, Phantom app is number two, whatever. That's probably a pretty good signal to start selling, and taking out at least like half of whatever it is. So yeah. Another thing I was gonna say too is that on the institute, so that's the retail side. I think that the institution, that the FOMO also exists for institutions and even hide out with individuals. Like when you have been exploring or dipping your toes into the crypto space for a while, and you asked about the altcoin DATS, digital asset treasury, right? Like
I was gonna be my next question.
Yeah,
because the investment banks are starting to feel FOMO on this stuff, I think.
For sure, and that's why Vanguard had to open up. Because too many of their clients were like, what the fuck? If you're not going to let us do Bitcoin, then we're going to go to BlackRock. And so that FOMO affects everybody just to some extent. And when Bitcoin goes from 125, and then by the end of October, it's at 150, everyone's going to want to jump in at that point. And so the institutional, like these digital asset treasuries for altcoins and the altcoin ETFs, I guess when you asked the question, it was like, I told you that like people are only starting to understand Bitcoin. So I think the individual ETFs, like a Cardano ETF or Solana one or Sui one, I don't know that they're going to be wildly successful. I just don't know that people are going to be that comfortable up the risk curve. But I do think that they're going to want general altcoin exposure. And since they don't really understand altcoins, I think that these basket ETFs and maybe a basket DAT or something like that, they'll do really well because people want exposure to like the top altcoins, right? But totally. They don't really, that's where the S&P does well, the other indexes do well, because they don't want to bet on a single horse. They just want the basket of things, right? They're like, okay, like I'll allocate 5% of my entire portfolio to Bitcoin, and let's do another 2 or 3% to altcoins and just put it across the top 10 altcoins or whatever, right? Top 20, whatever it is. And so I think these baskets will do well. And subsequently, the assets that happen to be the baskets will do well. And then there's going to be, there's probably going to be like one or two major asset treasury companies in each country that actually can do well as like individual asset ETFs like Solana or Sui or whatever. I don't think the smaller ones will actually be able to continue to raise and capture more value. So I think that any of the smaller ones that have launched will be consolidated amongst the top one or two. Yeah, and that's how I see it playing out. And then maybe like next cycle in 5 years from now or 4 years from now, we'll have a lot more interest in these altcoins as people start to understand them.
I love that. I think that's super, super interesting. And I'm thinking that we're going to get a lot more of these products for, you know, public market investors who are going to see all this crypto stuff moving much higher, and they're going to want to be able to play a part in it. And I love what you said there. And one of the things I wanted to kind of go back on and talk about real quick was, like, now that we've got the iBit sort of BlackRock ETF, you're seeing a really deep liquid options market start to unfold there. It's something that Bitcoin's never really had, and these options just kind of got approved earlier this year. And so we've got now some interesting data, and I was looking at the open interest by strike price, and there's like a huge, huge, huge cluster of open interest at the $100 strike price for this iBit, which makes sense. It's like this round number. And so basically it's showing a lot of these investors have calls that they've bought at $100 per iBit. And that would equal $175,000 per Bitcoin because of the ratio of iBit to Bitcoin. I think each iBit, or there's about one Bitcoin is always fixed at like 1,755 iBit shares or something like that. And so long story short, the market thinks, again, that's just a 40% move from 125K, just a 40% move. And that can happen this year in Bitcoin. But like, if we get that sort of move, again, I'm super optimistic that altcoins are going to really, really take a big rip. So I like your thesis as well, kind of about, you know, this could be the blow off top period. I saw Paul Tudor Jones on CNBC this morning talking about he thinks we're going to be getting some kind of blow off top here as well. He thinks he said this could be 1999, where it's like it just gets crazier and crazier and crazier until you don't even believe it. And then all of a sudden things, you know, the rug gets pulled. So it could go either way. And, you know, we'll see. Nobody's got the crystal ball. But what's kind of, you know, outside of, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, those fundamentals, are there any like altcoins that you think have that staying power that's going to last the next cycle? You know, and you could, you know, disclose if you have exposure or not, but do you have like one or two hot picks that you think, you know, might change the world, might last through the next cycle?
I think there's a lot. You know, there's, you know, because just think about like all of the successful major corporations around the world, and even the ones that compete in the same space, you know, and like there's a ton of them. And that's in each country, because crypto and the infrastructure is a global product. You know, you have so
and it's permissionless. Anybody could launch one too, right?
Anyone can launch one. People are using Ethereum and Solana and Sui and everything else. They're using them in every country in the world. And so, you know, there's so much room for so many of these things to exist and be successful. For, you know, like imagine that someone takes a chain that didn't really have any adoption. Let's say it's a Cardano or it's Polkadot or it's like, you know, Algorand or something like that. Like these chains that are like really good and capable, but like just no one uses them because like
ghost chains.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah, but all it would take for that chain to become economically valuable and have like more economic value than any other chain is one major, like let's say TikTok goes on Cardano and puts all transactions on chain. Now all of a sudden Cardano does more real transaction volume than every other chain in the world because one player decided to be more transparent and put everything on chain. So you never know what's going to happen. So, you know, and then I think and then things like cults like Cardano will probably exist forever because people believe in the cult. Just like no one's building on Cardano really, but it's still super valuable and people believe that it's going to be the next Bitcoin or whatever. And that's interesting thing too about these public speculative markets is that people continue like the token will have value as long as people are willing to buy it and sell it at a price. But when you ask about a few of them, like, you know, anyone who watches my channel or follows me knows that I'm very, very bullish on Sui.
Okay.
I've been following that story closely. You know, Sui was built by the former Meta team, right? The guys at Facebook and stuff with Zuckerberg. $2 billion of R&D went into creating Project Libra, or Diem, which is the one that Facebook got shut down.
Yeah, I remember that.
So $2 billion of R&D went into building that to create, and they were ready to launch and go live, right? And if they were allowed to do that, overnight, Facebook would have been the biggest bank and it's in the financial institution in the world. 4 billion customers, whatever, access to transactions on their chain. So if you're doing that and you're about to go live, you better be super confident that your technology is not going to have exploits or errors, and it's going to be very easy to use. And so $2 billion went into building this infrastructure and building their own coding language and smart contract language and parallel processing and all this stuff. And so like when that DM got shut down, you had several teams that were splintered from that. But like Mizzen Labs, which built Sui, is the main team that built the main language, built the infrastructure with the engineers. And so they are building like this like whole technology stack that allows anyone to build on Sui with on-chain storage and more transactions per second than anyone would need, the lowest latency for any like financial products to go on where you don't have to, settlement happens basically instantly. It's just so, and they have a really strong business development team, huge treasury, great technology, account abstraction. And so I think like there's going to be a lot of people who win in the application space. Right. And I think like Solana is like a really good one. I think Sui is a really good one. Those are like the bets. Something like BNB is going to be valuable because CZ and Binance, they're buying back like $1 billion+ of tokens every quarter and burning them. So you just have this crazy economic flywheel of a number go up forever as long as Binance is profitable, and Binance will always be profitable in perpetuity, right? Like even if DEXs like Aster end up taking significant market share, Binance will always still have 50% or more of the total trading volume that happens on anything. And they're expanding everything. They have unlimited resources and they continue to add value to the BNB token and network. So I don't see that slowing down anytime soon. So those will all be multi-generational. I don't think they'll ever go out of business. I don't think they'll ever shut down. I think that's the future of the internet, as these layer ones. And I think those are good bets for now. On the application layer, who knows? Who knows? One of the things that we're working on, though, that I think is really interesting is capital formation. You know, like, how does the whole process of these companies getting funded, distributing tokens to retail investors, to institutional investors, transparently, in a regulated fashion, and trying to get these new crypto startups to have tokens to be more transparent and more reliable, the same way that a company goes public on the New York Stock Exchange when they've got investment bankers and people that are supporting liquidity and market making and price and stability. That is probably going to happen with our markets too. So we're going to find really great, awesome companies who have existing revenue, business models, killer teams, who want to put their business on chain, who want to switch their economic model to value creation of the token side of the business. And so right now, one of the things that we're working on right now is doing that. So yeah, I can't say too much right now, but like, when I told you in 2021, we started making money again, that's when we launched Paid Network, which was like one of the top two launch pads in the space. Since the bear market, we've been thinking about how does this industry evolve for like ICOs and IDOs, and that's why I moved back to America. It was actually, how do I bring the American markets into this capital formation segment? And so so we've made some pretty good progress on that. And hopefully by the end of the year, you'll start to see some stuff from us when it comes down to like institutions, Wall Street, publicly listed companies, doing these crowdfunding models and launching them to take them public.
Gosh, that's going to be incredible. And hopefully we could have you back on the show sometime very soon to talk about that as you guys kind of come out of stealth. We would love to kind of dig in on that. Kyle, where can folks follow along with your journey? We greatly appreciated your time today. I want to make sure everybody knows where to kind of follow along.
Yeah, so Kyle, C-H-A-S-S-E, Chasse. So you can find me on Twitter or X, that one. It's Kyle_Chasse. My YouTube is Kyle Chasse Crypto. Or if you just go to my name, kylechasse.com, you've got all the links there and stuff like that.
Beautiful.
So I make daily videos on YouTube Monday through Friday, post relentlessly on X. And yeah, that's really where you can find me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And cheers to price discovery mode. Cheers to a good bull market. And we'll talk again soon. Everybody at home listening, thank you so much for tuning in. That was the inside look of a long-term crypto veteran, crypto titan here, painting a very optimistic picture for where we're going. So thank you, everyone, and tune back in next week for another great guest.